U.S. Democratic candidate Joe Biden maintains a lead in Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Nevada, inching closer to presidency as President Donald Trump has turned to courts to try to challenge the votes. Iran's foreign minister, in a meeting with a Cuban counterpart, says Tehran and Havana have stood together in the face of U.S. economic terrorism. And the European Union is set to impose tariffs on $4 billion of U.S. imports in retaliation for Washington subsidies to plane maker Boeing. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in for World News. Our top story, Democratic candidate Joe Biden is inching closer to victory in the U.S. presidential election as President Donald Trump turns to the courts to challenge the results. Biden is leading Trump in the key states of Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and Pennsylvania, while the president is ahead in Alaska and North Carolina. Race is particularly tight in Georgia, where Biden's lead over Trump is in the hundreds. Now, Biden has so far secured 264 out of 270 electoral votes he needs to become president, while Trump has around 214. Trump campaign has filed several lawsuits now with states to complain about voting irregularities and calling for a halt to the ballot count. Biden and his supporters, however, say that every vote must be counted. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, people gathered outside a ballot counting center celebrating in anticipation of a Biden victory. A similar rally was also held outside the White House in Maricopa County, Arizona, state where Biden still holds a lead. Armed Trump supporters protested the results outside an election center. They reiterated Trump's allegations that Democrats are rigging this vote. Meanwhile, several prominent Republicans have rallied behind the U.S. president over his claims that Democrats are using illegal votes and trying to steal the election.
I think you're going to see in the next 48 hours real evidence of systematic voting irregularities. There's a complaint filed by the U.S. attorney to the U.S. attorney in Michigan, someone, I think, in the post office who was told to backdate ballots instead of November the 4th, it'd be November the 3rd, so they'd be counted. Democracy depends upon fair elections.
Graham described results in Philadelphia as crooked as a snake. Representative Kevin McCarthy, who leads the Republican minority in the House, said the results are far from over. Senator Ted Cruz claims Pennsylvania's Democratic Attorney General had ordered vote counting in Philadelphia to continue until Joe Biden wins. However, other Republicans distanced themselves from Donald Trump's claims of fraud or adopted a more balanced stance. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said every legal vote should be counted, while illegally submitted ballots should not. Trump's campaign has filed lawsuits in several states, reaching out to donors to try to raise at least $60 million for legal fees. Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives has called the Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden president-elect, even though vote counting is still underway in battleground states.
President-elect Biden has a strong mandate to lead, and he'll have a strong Democratic House with him and many Democrats in the Senate. It's very important to the
health and well-being. Top Democrat Nancy Pelosi said it's clear Biden will be the next president of the United States, hailing him as a unifier. She also referred to current President Donald Trump as a lame duck. Pelosi warned, however, that Trump will try to destroy the credibility of the election and do mischief as long as he remains in office. Political commentator Margaret Kimberly says the desire to get President Donald Trump out of office is the main reason for the huge turnout in the U.S. presidential election.
What is surprising is the fact that it's taken, this is now the third day of counting votes, but that's an indication of the huge turnout that was created, frankly, by Donald Trump and by the desire to get this man out of office so that many of those who sat out in 2016 were moved to get to the polls in 2020. But it's interesting, Biden appears to be headed to victory. It's much more difficult for Donald Trump to get there. And that is why he is calling these lawsuits, which I believe will be futile. We're going to have a Biden presidency, but that brings with it some challenges because there's a large number of voters who just want to get rid of Trump, who have not really asked much of Biden. And he is in a position, frankly, to create huge problems in this country and around the world.
Political commentator Netfa Freeman says that U.S. presidential election is used to misdirect radical energy of Americans.
People have been mobilized to dislike Trump, and he's very easily dislikable. But at the same time, because we're not asking for anything, there's some serious problems that the country has that will not be addressed by a Democratic presidential candidate, particularly Joe Biden. For example, the economic extreme crisis that this country's in, that's been exacerbated because of the pandemic. There is the issue of police, really rampant police brutality and extrajudicial killings that Joe Biden has promised that he wants to increase funding for the police and support the police. And so there's really no difference there. And then there's a threat of war that we don't really hear a lot about, and the media has done a good job of, if not being in line with the march to war, they definitely don't report on it. And so particularly with against Russia and China. And so these are the things that I think the public could be very well blindsided by, and that a lot of hopes have been put into the election. In fact, the uprisings that we saw right after murder of George Floyd, they have kind of been misdirected, which is how they use the electoral process a lot in this country, to misdirect the radical expressions and energies of the populace, particularly of people, non-white people.
Iran's foreign minister says that his country and Cuba have stood together despite U.S. economic terrorism.
Iran and Cuba have stood together in the face of pressure from the United States, pressure that can only be considered as economic terrorism.
Zarif made the remarks in a meeting with his Cuban counterpart Bruno Rodriguez in Havana. And Rodriguez described the meeting as a very important occasion to boost political and economic ties between the two countries. Zaire's visit to Havana and his meeting with Cuban officials comes in line with the two nations' efforts to strengthen mutual support in the face of Washington's sanctions. Zaire visited Cuba 2 days after he arrived in Venezuela, another Latin American ally subjected to U.S. sanctions. Joining us now in Rochester is Judith Bellow, member of the Administrative Committee of the United National Anti-War Movement. And with respect to this story, a lot of similarities, between Havana and Tehran. Your thoughts, please.
I agree. There's a lot of similarities. The U.S. has been oppressing both of these countries since the 50s. And it's a real severe form of persecution to shut a country out of the international monetary system, which is what the U.S. has attempted to do in both cases. So it's a form of war, really. I mean, in medieval times, and they called it a siege. It's siege warfare, and it's attempting to starve the people into abiding by your will. And here it's presented as sort of attempting to pressure the people into being more favorable to the U.S., but I don't know anybody who ever liked someone who starved them and took away their medication and took away their rights as human beings. So it's a very disturbing scenario. One thing I will say is I'm really very happy to see that not only is the axis of resistance in the Middle East coming together, with Iran as a central player, but also there's a new axis of resistance coming together across the global south. And that's really, I think, a very positive development because it allows these countries, Iran and Cuba, Venezuela, and, you know, many more countries that are under sanctions right now will hopefully become involved in an ability to have their own trade network and your own ability to be self-sustaining without having to be involved in what the U.S. has always considered a global monetary system, but since it shut so many countries out, is actually being sidelined. And you're developing new trade routes, new support systems, becoming more self-sufficient. And I think as horrible as the U.S. has treated you, it's also a wonderful development for not only for Iran and Cuba and Venezuela, but for the world in general, that you are finding ways to support one another and to open new futures.
Right. And Judith, it seemed like the Obama administration, for just for a split second, tried to actually take a step in the direction of thawing tensions with Havana. And it seemed like, you know, they really wanted to build on that. Even, you know, I mean, Barack Obama turned around and said, look, a lot of time has transpired since we've had serious tensions with Havana. It's time for the, you know, the U.S. government and the Cuban people to try to turn a new chapter, a new page. What happened? When, I mean, the difference a day makes and an administration makes, came Donald Trump and the Republicans are back in power, and we saw all that get kind of blown into the wind. What happened?
I don't know if I can say what happened. I think the politics in this country are very chaotic and confused, and that the election where Trump was elected, he wasn't prepared to be president, and he's being very erratic. He's making decisions. He's not only dismantled the U.S. Blossoming relationship with Cuba, he dismantled the Iran deal that allowed you to avoid some of the sanctions and to have a better relationship with the United States. He's undermined the big nuclear treaties with Russia, which is a very dangerous and actually terrifying turn of events. And he backed out of the environmental organization and treaties that had been coming together. And I think it was a sad day for the United States when Donald Trump became president. However, I wouldn't expect any really wondrous instantaneous changes under a Democrat, although I do hope that at this point Biden will win, because certainly he will backtrack somewhat on these really important treaties. I mean, the rule of international law is based on these treaties. And when a country withdraws from all the most significant treaties that it's involved in, causing them really to be broken, this is a renegade that is breaking the law and making it so others find it difficult to abide by the law as well. So, what's happening with Cuba and Iran and Venezuela and many other countries is a tragedy. But the destruction of these international treaties is a very dangerous sign as well. And I'd really like to see some improvement. I don't expect anything perfect, certainly, because the United States government is certainly united in its desire to control the world in any way possible. But I think that within reason, some of these will be ameliorated, and I really hope so, because I'd like to see the people of the world and the people of Tehran and Iran, the people of Cuba and Venezuela and many African countries, Yemen, I'd love to see all of you living wonderful lives, better lives, at peace and harmony with the world and able to develop. And I have to say that America is also, the United States, I won't call us America, the United States is also causing suffering from this poor governance that has been going on intensely for the last 4 years, but in a milder form even before that. And the people here also are, and that's how Trump got elected, really, is because the people here knew that there were problems and that their needs weren't being met, and they were hoping to that sort of a renegade, somebody totally new, would totally wave a magic wand and things would get better. But instead, they got someone who went around just breaking everything in his purview, and that's really been a great disaster for us.
Thank you, Judith, for joining us with your very compassionate and basically a considerate perspective to all this. Out of Rochester is Judith Bellow, member of the Administrative Committee of the United National Anti-War Movement. They're joining us. Meanwhile, Hezbollah has condemned U.S. sanctions on head of Lebanon's biggest Christian political bloc as a blatant and gross interference in the country's internal affairs. Lebanese resistance movement said U.S. sanctions on Gebran Bassel aimed to force a big political faction to submit to Washington's dictates. U.S. Treasury Department blacklisted Bassel over ties to Hezbollah and alleged corruption. Bassel says U.S. sanctions will not force him to turn his back on the Lebanese people. This comes at a time when Lebanon is in political crisis and Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri is trying to form a new government. Bassel is leader of the Free Patriotic Movement, which has a political alliance with Hezbollah. The party has defended the resistance movement as vital to the defense of Lebanon. The European Union is likely to impose tariffs on $4 billion of U.S. products in retaliation for Washington's subsidies to aircraft maker Boeing. An EU diplomat said the tariffs will target imports, including planes and airplane parts, and could kick into effect next Tuesday or Wednesday. Many European governments have already backed the tariffs, which are expected to be put in place after a meeting of EU trade ministers Monday. Now, the move comes in response to U.S. tariffs on European goods over subsidies to Boeing rival Airbus. The World Trade Organization gave the European Union the go-ahead on this. However, the U.S. has threatened to respond if the bloc chooses to impose the retaliatory measures. A number of European countries record a steep rise in coronavirus infections and deaths as the continent is grappling with a second wave of outbreak. France has confirmed now a record high of 60,000 new cases and 828 new deaths. Italy also reported nearly 38,000 new infections, its biggest daily tally thus far. The health ministry also reported a six-month record of 446 deaths in a 24-hour time span. This as the country's worst-hit regions have returned to lockdown. Russia also reported over 20,500 new infections, its largest daily caseload to date. Hungary registered over 100 daily coronavirus-related deaths and more than 4,700 new infections. Ukraine also posted a new record in its daily virus deaths with 201 fatalities. Germany also reported more than 21,500 new cases. A Palestinian in Israeli prison has ended his nearly four-month hunger strike after reaching a deal with the Israeli regime to release him. Maher Al-Akhras is to be released now on the 26th of November. He was on hunger strike for 103 days in protests against Israel's so-called administrative detention policy. Al-Akhras was arrested near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus in July. He was then put in administrative detention. That's a policy Israel uses to hold Palestinian suspects with no charge or trial for an indefinite period of time. According to a Palestinian rights group, Al-Damir, out of 4,400 Palestinians in Israeli jails, 355 of them are being held under this so-called administrative detention system. International rights groups have called Israel's policy a violation of international and humanitarian law. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
The bustle of life. the sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
Holy Defense.
In the name of God, salam dear listeners and welcome to the program. The 1975 Algiers Accord was the agreement that Saddam had signed with Iran's Shahs before the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The accord settled the existing disputes between Iran and Iraq on the borders and the Arvand River. On September 17, 1980, Saddam tore up the Algiers Accord before the TV cameras and claimed Iraqi full control over the river. Then on September 22nd, the Iraqi army started an all-out aggression against the Islamic Republic of Iran along the common borders with Iran. Saddam sought three goals in invading Iran. First, he wanted to annul the Algiers Accord. Secondly, he wanted to separate Khuzestan province from the Iranian territory. And thirdly, he intended to overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Iraqi dictator failed to achieve any of his ambitions of invading Iran. Therefore, as a result of 8 years of stiff resistance of the Iranian nation, he was forced to accept 1975 Algiers Accord again and give in to Iran's demands. Saddam, in his sixth letter to the then Iranian president Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, while admitting the acceptance of the accord, wrote, "With this decision, anything has become clear, and thus everything that you wanted and stressed will materialize, and there remains nothing but exchanging of documents." The last British ambassador to Tehran, Anthony Parsons, wrote, after Saddam reaccepting of the Algiers Accord, "Saddam failed in invasion of Iran because of the Iranian resistance, and when he noticed that he could not dominate over Iran, he reneged on his conditions." After accepting the Algiers Accord by Saddam and withdrawal of the Iraqi forces from all of the occupied regions, it was the turn for implementation of other articles of the UN Security Council Resolution 598. The most important paragraph was the exchanging of POWs, declaration of the aggressor and determination of the damages inflicted upon Iran. Former UN Secretary General Javier Pérez de Coya, in order to implement paragraphs 6 and 7 of Resolution 598, wrote a letter to Iran and Iraq on August 14, 1991 and asked the two countries to declare their reasons for the initiator of the war. This request faced with Iraq's ridicule, and the country presented a very hollow response on August 26th with a series of documents. But the Islamic Republic of Iran sent substantive documents in bulk form on September 15. The Iranian documents were based on Article 51 of the UN Charter pertaining to legitimate defense. General-in-Chief, after consultation with a group of his experts and studying Iranian and Iraqi documents, gave them to an impartial group. Finally, Dekoya announced his opinion on December 9, 1991, stressing in an official report that Iraq was the initiator of the war. Part of Article 6 of the report reads, "The outstanding event that I have mentioned in Article 5 under the title of Violation of International Rights and Regulations was the September 22, 1980 attack on Iran, which, according to the UN Charter, internationally recognized principles and laws or international morals, is not justifiable and leads to the responsibility of hostility." The UN Secretary General also said in paragraph 7 of the report, "Even if, before the start of hostility, there had been some aggressions from Iran to the Iraqi soil, such aggressions cannot justify the Iraqi aggression to Iran, which would result in the continued occupation of Iran's soil. An aggression that breaches prohibition of usage of force, which is one of the authoritative principles of the international rights." The UN Secretary General's report on announcement of the aggressor was a great victory for Iran. Although there were very obvious documents and evidence on the issue, the international community had kept tacit for several years vis-à-vis the aggression. It was in fact the Iranian resistance that forced the UN to bow to the legal demand of Iran. After this UN move, Saddam wrote a letter to Iran's president. As a matter of fact, his intention of sending letters to Iran was to settle his differences with Iran temporarily and cause Iran not to insist on implementation of other paragraphs of the resolution. Some of the Western and Arabic radios and news agencies said that Saddam's second time accepting of the Algiers Accord indicated that he was the aggressor and initiator of war. German radio Köln said, "Saddam in 1980 started the war against Iran with ignoring 1975 Algiers Accord." Kuwaiti agency quoting Austrian diplomatic sources said, "Saddam, who submitted before Iran and accepted Iran's conditions for peace, has officially confessed the initiation of war against Iran." The Saudi radio, also quoting military experts, said, "Accepting Iran's conditions by Saddam is the reason for the regime's invasion of the Iranian soil." Dear listeners, during the eight-year imposed war, Saddam's supporters in the West and the East didn't let even a single resolution be approved at the UN Security Council against the Iraqi dictator. Their ultimate request was the declaration of ceasefire without even mentioning the necessity of pullout of the invading country from the occupied regions. The Western and Eastern powers and the regional cohorts and henchmen were seeking to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. They generously equipped Iraq with the state-of-the-art weaponry and provided it with the latest intelligence and logistical aids. Moreover, they assisted Iraq financially. Militarily, Saddam's army was the fourth army in the world with 1.8 million forces. It possessed 600 aircraft and 6,000 tanks. This army had gathered valuable experiences during the eight-year war. So, the Iraqi war machine had turned into a threat to the regional countries and the vested interests of the big powers. That's why they thought of annihilating this machine. It is naive to say that Saddam's aggression against Kuwait was only due to his ambition. There is ample documents and evidence to indicate that he invaded the southern neighbor upon the Washington's green light. This move gave the U.S. the pretext for military expedition together with its allies and accomplices to the region. The UN admission of Iraq's aggression against Iran was indeed to announce the expiry date of Saddam.
Man. the spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين واللعن الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. One of the most important topics in Islamic ethics is the topic of yaqeen or certainty. The difference between us and the infallible imams and generally infallibles is while we believe in something and we are not certain about it, they believe in something and they are certain. For example, about committing sins. While we know that when we commit sin, inevitably we go to hell, at the same time we commit sin, they believe in the same fact, but they know that committing sin is equal to going to the hell, and they see this fact as we see something by our eyes. So while we are not sure about something that we know, they are sure about the result of everything. As a result, they never commit sin as infallibles, but there is probability and possibility of committing sin by us. Once Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, enters the mosque and meets a young person whose face was pale, was not normal. Prophet asked him, "How are you?" He replied, "I'm at the level of certainty." This is the famous hadith, the famous narration, which is narrated in both Shiite and Sunni sources, with a subtle difference, but it is narrated by both. After Prophet asked him this question, he replies, "I'm at the level of certainty." Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, tells him, "Everything has a sign. What is the sign of your certainty? How you have come to this conclusion that you have reached the level of certainty?" He replies, "I'm in an atmosphere, in an environment that I see the heavens, I see the paradise, I see the hell. I see the people of paradise and the people of the hell, it seems that everything is real in front of me. I witness and I see by my eyes all of these realities. Even according to some of the narrations that young person said, even now I can point out to the people of the paradise and to the people of the hell. Which one of these people are the people of the paradise and which one are the residents of the hell? But according to that narration, the Prophet forbids. We do not have this right to mention such a fact, even though probably we have some knowledge, some awareness of these facts, but we do not have right to express it, to manifest it.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here. Who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
After the response of this young person, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, accepted his claim. He said, you're right. And considered what he said as a lesson to the others. And the end of the story also is interesting. At the end of the story, this young person asked Prophet Muhammad to request God to give him martyrdom, to be martyred in the way of God and for the sake of Allah. And there is in the narration that the next fighting, the next war between Muslims and non-Muslims, this young person was the 10th person who became martyr. This is also another example of reaching the level of certainty. In the Holy Quran, in the chapter At-Takathur, God Almighty says, "Kalla law ta'lamuna 'ilma al-yaqin latarawunna al-jahim." According to the verses of the Holy Quran, there are some realities that normal people cannot grasp it, are not aware of those realities. We have in some of the Quranic verses, everything on earth is glorifying the Lord, is praising God. أَمَّنْ شَيْءٍ إِلَّا يُصَبَّهُ بَحَمْدِهِ. But the problem is that we as normal people have not reached the level to realize this fact, to realize these realities. According to this verse of the Holy Quran, كَلَّا لَوْ تَعْلَمُونَ عِلْمَ الْيَقِينَ لَتَرَوُنَّ الْجَحِيمِ. Whenever you reach the level of certainty, or whenever, according to this verse, whenever you gain the certain knowledge, عِلْمَ الْيَقِينِ, or the knowledge of conviction, or whatever you translate it, لَتَرَوُنَّ الْجَحِيمِ, inevitably you would see and you would witness the hell. Although in some of the exegesis of the Holy Quran, some of the commentaries of the Holy Quran, our scholars have translated or interpreted these verses in another way, but the apparent meaning of this verse, which is in harmony with the story that I retold some minutes ago, is very clear. Whenever you reach at the level of certainty, you would surely see the hell. You would see the hell. We have created in front of ourselves the curtains. As a result, we are not able to see those realities. These are obstacles that we have made. We have created. As a result, whenever we remove these obstacles from our eyes, we would see those realities. And it's interesting to know that inevitably such a thing would happen after death. After death, because we are no longer attached to this world, this type of obstacles, this type of curtains are no longer in front of our eyes. As a result, we would see these realities. But at that time, probably it's a little bit late, because we have to be aware of these realities in order to work in accordance with those realities. Otherwise, after death, the time of test, the time of experiment has finished. But the way through which we are able to be aware of these realities is exactly what we are talking about, is to gain the conviction, to gain certainty. Thank you very much for your time and attention. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Rahimallahu man qara'a al-Fatiha ma'a as-salawat.
Allahumma salli ala sayyidina wa maulana Muhammadin wa ala alihi wa sallam.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Tense vote count in the U.S. presidential election got underway on Tuesday night, 3rd of November. as Donald Trump and Joe Biden started to notch expected state wins. The president won Kentucky, which carried 8 votes in the Electoral College and several other southern states, whilst Joe Biden captured the safely Democratic state of Vermont and several others on the East Coast. Results in the crucial battleground states were not expected for several hours at least. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalists David Smith and Sam Levine, writing for The Guardian. The piece is titled Trump and Biden Begin to Claim States with Tense Vote Count Underway. Stay with us for more of David Smith and Sam Levine's article. Tense vote count in the U.S. presidential election got underway on Tuesday night, 3rd of November, as Donald Trump and Joe Biden started to notch expected state wins. The president won Kentucky, which carried 8 votes in the Electoral College, and several other southern states, whilst Joe Biden captured the safely Democratic state of Vermont and several others on the East Coast. Results in the crucial battleground states were not expected for several hours at least. From New York to Phoenix, from Detroit to Los Angeles, even as coronavirus cases surged in swing states, citizens waited patiently to determine whether Donald Trump will serve a second term in the White House or make way for his Democratic challenger Joe Biden. A record of more than 100 million people had voted early, with Democrats thought to have the edge. So Trump, a Republican, was relying on what he called a red wave on Election Day itself. Experts predicted the final total could be around 160 million votes, a turnout rate of more than two-thirds of the eligible voting population, the highest turnout in more than a century. Both candidates signaled confidence before polls closed on Tuesday night. Donald Trump, the first impeached president to run for re-election, expressed faith that the size of his campaign rallies will prove a more reliable measure of support than conventional national polling, which has consistently shown Joe Biden leading. "We're feeling very good," Trump told the conservative Fox News channel, his voice sounding scratchy after holding 14 rallies in 3 days in a last-ditch campaign blitz. "We have crowds like nobody has ever had before. I think that translates into a lot of votes, and we're going to see very soon." But the president sounded more downbeat during a visit to his campaign headquarters in Virginia. "I'm not thinking about concession speech or acceptance speech yet. Hopefully we'll be doing only one of those two. And you know, winning is easy. Losing is never easy. Not for me, it's not." Joe Biden, who at 77 would be the oldest U.S. president ever elected if he wins this election, visited his childhood home in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He wrote in ink on the living room wall, "From this house to the White House, with the grace of God. Joe Biden, 3rd of November 2020. He then made a last-ditch appeal to voters in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, grabbing a microphone and addressing an impromptu street gathering in Philadelphia. "Trump's got a lot of things backwards," he said through a face mask. "If you elect me, I'm going to be an American president. There's going to be no red states or blue states, just the United States of America." Later, back home in Wilmington, Delaware, Biden was asked about the destabilizing potential of Donald Trump claiming victory prematurely. "Presidents can't determine what votes are counted and not counted, and voters determine who's president," Biden said. "No matter what he does and no matter what he says, the votes are going to count." concerns about voter suppression and voter intimidation hung over the election, but as the day went on, election observers said it went relatively smoothly. This may have been a result of increased awareness about the issues, in addition to so many people having cast their ballots early, easing pressure on election officials. Kirsten Clark, the president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, which runs an election protection hotline, said, "We're not seeing major systematic barriers that are obstructing voters' ability to participate in the process en masse." Even so, a federal judge also ordered the Postal Service to conduct a last-minute sweep of its facilities to search for nearly 300,000 ballots unaccounted for. The agency said in a late afternoon court filing it was unable to complete the last-minute sweep by the court-imposed deadline without disrupting its election day schedule. There were also reports of misinformation. Voters in Flint, Michigan received a robocall telling them to vote on Wednesday because of long lines, Dana Nessel, the state's attorney general, said. New York's attorney general said she was investigating reports that 10 million people received a robocall telling them to stay safe and stay at home. Twitter also flagged several tweets from Mike Roman, a Trump campaign operative, spreading false information that suggested improper voting practices in Philadelphia, a key city that will likely shape the outcome of the presidential race. The election is widely seen as a hinge moment in history that will decide whether Trump was an aberration or a direction. After 4 years of domestic and international turmoil, Democrats are hoping to seize the chance to halt his populist, nationalist, Make America Great Again movement in its tracks. Donald Trump was hoping for a replay of 2016, when, as a businessman and reality TV star with no prior political experience, he beat Hillary Clinton in a seismic repudiation of the Washington establishment and its consensus on issues long assumed settled. But opinion polls showed Joe Biden significantly better placed than Hillary Clinton at the same stage. The Trump camp remained defiant. Jason Miller, a campaign advisor to Donald Trump, said, "We feel better and more confident about our positioning now in 2020 than we did at this exact moment in 2016. Joe Biden appeared on course to win the popular vote as Hillary Clinton did, but Donald Trump still had a narrow path to victory in the Electoral College, which determines who takes the White House. All eyes were on the battleground states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, Georgia, Arizona, and North Carolina. Patience was the watchword, however. Television networks promised to exercise extreme caution to avoid calling results prematurely, mindful of the confusion that set in during the disputed 2000 election between George W. Bush and Al Gore. Early voting includes 64 million mail-in ballots, meaning that the count could take hours, days, or even weeks before producing a definitive winner. There were fears that Donald Trump could exploit that delay to prematurely declare victory, spread conspiracy theories, and mobilize armed supporters. On Monday, Trump threw a match into the tinderbox by suggesting that a Supreme Court ruling allowing Pennsylvania to accept mail ballots sent by Election Day and received up to 3 days after the election would induce violence in the streets. Twitter labeled the tweet with a warning that it might be misleading about an election or other civic process. Trump aides and conservative media have also been promoting a rosy narrative about polling and the likelihood of the president achieving victory, raising concerns that he and his supporters will then assume a defeat can only be explained in terms of fraud by Democrats. Chris Ruddy, a media executive and a friend of President Donald Trump, told The Guardian. He's a very confident guy, and I think nothing is shaking that confidence. Fearful of potential convulsions, shops and stores were boarded up in cities including Washington, D.C., New York, and Raleigh, North Carolina. Concrete barriers and a non-scalable fence were erected outside the White House, where Donald Trump was due to host an election night party for hundreds of people, yet another potential COVID-19 threat. Joe Biden was set to address the nation from Wilmington, Delaware, later in the evening. 8 state attorneys general, representing Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, New Mexico, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, warned that they would not tolerate voter intimidation. Grassroots activists were mobilizing to protect the results and ensure every vote is counted. Both sides have hired battalions of lawyers for a potential post-election fight. On Monday, a federal judge in Texas rejected a Republican bid to throw out about 127,000 votes already cast at drive-through voting sites in the Democratic-leading Houston area of Texas. In the final days of the campaign, Donald Trump has continued to downplay the coronavirus and threatened to fire Anthony Fauci, the top infectious disease expert in the country, even as the virus surged to an all-time high of nearly 100,000 cases per day. No president has won re-election with an approval rating as low as Donald Trump's average of 44%. He is in danger of becoming the first incumbent president to lose re-election since his fellow Republican George H.W. Bush was beaten by Bill Clinton in 1992. Barack Obama, whom Biden served as vice president for 8 years, said Trump's push to stop counting votes on election night was undemocratic. "That's what a two-bit dictator does," he told a rally in Miami, Florida on Monday. "If you truly believe in democracy, you want every vote counted."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.